A couple of observations by Pierre. He credits the fact that they went to ryegrass as completely changing the character of Shenkato. Remember what I said earlier, that Shenkato was on the lighter side. And in this case, he thinks that the competition at the surface forced the roots lower. And when that happened, it changed the character of the wine such that it took on a lot more body and structure. And before, it was too light, which is why they essentially declassified it. But when they started getting different raw material, then they thought it was worthy of Premier Cru status. But I think even so, when you look at the example of Shenkato versus its neighbor, you can see that its neighbor is a considerably bigger wine. Pierre also notes that he thinks that in another 3 or 4 years, you can probably begin attacking the 2006s without committing infanticide, whereas tes idées pour le 2005? En termes de longévité
pour le 2005, c'était la belle année. Hein, je crois qu'on a eu un été fabuleux avec pas d'orage, pas de gel, tout bien. Maintenant, je suis en bon climat, donc c'est un vin qui est quand même très complexe. Pour moi, il faudra l'attendre un petit peu quand même. Mm. On est encore sur un vin jeune.
So he's basically agreeing with what I said a moment ago about the 2005s, where 2005 was one of those years where nothing went wrong. I think I may have told you the story that Michel wrote. For those of you that came to the seminar with Michel, might have heard. But in essence, Michel Gros had a neighbor, and it's okay, Tony. A little. No, that wasn't his cell phone. It's, Tony's just tall, is all. I can't. I can walk underneath those and not hit anything. But, but anyway, back to the anecdote about Michel. He had a neighbor that he said in 2005 made two treatments, and his tractor broke down, and he never made another treatment. Yet he brought in, apparently, absolutely perfect grapes. And that's the kind of vintage that 2005 was. Basically, other than a small spot in May in Echizo, there was no hail, there was no rot, there was no nothing. It was one of those vintages where Burgundian after Burgundian told me that if you screwed up 2005, you probably should find another line of work.
On parle de Les Saint-Georges.
On peut parler des Saint-Georges, oui. Donc les Saint-Georges. Je vais reprendre ça.
Saint-Georges, c'est le normalement grand cru, on en a parlé tout à l'heure. C'est vraiment la situation idéale, là où la vigne, vraiment, on voit qu'elle se porte bien, qu'elle n'a pas de souci de trop d'humidité ou de trop de sécheresse, parce que la pente est idéale, parce que le sous-sol est relativement drainant. C'est-à-dire que si on arrive à avoir des orages près des vendanges, on ne va pas avoir d'eau qui va stagner, on ne va pas avoir de dilution dans les raisins. Mais par contre, on a une terre qui est quand même structurée avec de l'argile qui va garder suffisamment d'humidité pour que, dans les cas inverses, on n'ait pas de problème de stress hydrique.
So, Pierre explains that Les Saint-Georges, which is, in his view, the grand cru of Nuits, or perhaps we could say the shadow grand cru of Nuits, has perfect drainage, which is to say that it has enough clay that it retains water such that there is very little hydric stress. At the same time, if it rains before the vintage, it allows enough drainage so that there's never any stagnant water and it can drain away, which makes it less likely that the grapes will engorge themselves on too much water, which is what you're looking to do. And in some terroirs, because biologically it takes approximately 3 days for rain to get to the grapes, in So a lot of people in terroirs that have very high proportions of clay, if it rains, generally they're out there within 2 days to try and get the grapes in before they start swelling, which if you believe, as most Burgundians do, that the rough proportion of solids and liquids that you're after is 2/3 liquid, 1/3 solid. And it is extremely frustrating if you have worked for 9 months to get perfect grapes and a last minute rainstorm completely upsets or distorts the balance between liquids and solids. And so it's one of the things about Le Saint-Georges that is good. Another aspect that I think is highly underrated about the very, very best terroirs is that the fact that they are what the French call drainant, in other words, they drain excess liquid away, is that you can get back in the vineyards sooner. You can't take equipment in the vineyards to treat. Let's say it's warm and humid and it rains. But now it's warm and really humid. And a vineyard that becomes waterlogged, you can't take machinery in there because you'll slip all over the place. And if you slip with the tractor, you're going to wipe out vines. A vineyard that drains relatively quickly, you can be back in there in 2 days. A vineyard that doesn't, it's 4 or 5. And with the virulence of some maladies, 2 days of waiting is enough where you can allow rot to install itself on a basis that is very hard to get rid of. At that point, you're always playing catch-up. And so one of the reasons that the Grand Crus and the very best Premier Crus tend to consistently give good wine, irrespective of vintage, is because of this. They can actually get into the vineyards and treat. If you have a vineyard that won't allow you to do that, in other words, it's stockpiling water, your only solution is very, very expensive, and that is to hire day workers, what they call tâcherons, to come in, and they'll actually load people up with things that look like scuba tanks, and they have the treatments there, and they'll go in and spray by hand. But that's when you're happy your parcel is small. It's one of the few times.
Saint-Georges, elle est plantée en trois parties. Une partie qui doit avoir dans les 70 ans, peut-être même plus. Et les deux autres parties qui ont aujourd'hui entre 35 et 40 ans.
So, Le Saint-Georges has essentially been replanted, or their parcel of Le Saint-Georges, which, by the way, is slightly over a hectare, 1.08 hectares. So, they have a little over 2.5 acres. And it's been planted three different times. You've got one parcel that is 70 plus years of age, and the two others are in the 35 to 40 year range.
Donc elle a été replantée avec des sélections du domaine. On n'est pas encore dans les périodes des clones, donc c'est toujours les vieilles sélections d'Henri Goujon.
So, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning about their replanting process, this was all planted by self-selected domain vines, and it was for the most part before the clones, so there are no clones in Le Saint-Georges, or I should say in the Gouges parcel of Le Saint-Georges.
Je pense que c'est tout ce qu'on peut en dire. C'est une vigne qui est quand même. C'est une vigne qui est. Ah, le vin, ben, c'est. Oui, c'est quand même. C'est surtout en année un peu difficile qu'on voit très nettement que Saint-Georges est toujours un cran au-dessus des autres. Et que, bon, qu'il soit grand cru ou pas grand cru, ça ne va pas changer grand-chose. Mais on voit toujours qu'il y a plus de complexité et que c'est un vin qui est toujours un peu plus haut que les autres.
So. Pierre is saying that at the Domaine, this is, in his view, always their best wine because it has what they call a dimension supplémentaire, which is essentially, it has another gear, it has another dimension, especially of complexity. And it is this aspect that makes it the best wine in the cellar, or consistently the best wine in the cellar. One of the the interesting things that he points out, though, is it doesn't really matter at the end of the day whether it's a Premier Cru or a Grand Cru. The wine is the wine, and it's to be judged on that basis, and simply putting something on a label doesn't change the wine. So in their view, it's a Grand Cru, but whether it's recognized as such or not, it sells like one. So it's convinced a lot of fans. Yes, sir.
When Pierre replants, how long does the vine develop until he includes it in his Premier Cru, for instance?
Ça, c'est une bonne question.
Oui, quand on replante, quel que soit le, si c'est village, premier cru ou grand cru, les trois premières années, on n'a pas droit à l'appellation.
Ouais.
Mais après, on rentre directement dans l'appellation sur laquelle on est.
Oui, voilà. Non, je sais, mais je pense qu'il voulait savoir simplement combien de temps avant que tu mettes dans
le cuvée. L'assemblage.
Ouais.
Si on a une parcelle qui est en très vieille vigne, par exemple un hectare qui a 70 ans, on va replanter peut-être un cinquième en jeune vigne. Au bout de 4 ou 5 ans, on va commencer l'assemblée. Parce qu'en fin de compte, la jeune vigne qui va apporter plus de fraîcheur, plus de fruits, va être bénéfique à l'assemblage. La vieille vigne, souvent, fait des vins qui sont durs, qui sont trop concentrés. Et c'est plutôt un bienfait d'apporter de la jeune vigne.
Essentially, there are two answers. The answer for everyone in Burgundy is that you don't have the right to include fruit that hasn't seen its third leaf. So it doesn't matter, you can't use it. You can make rosé out of it, but you can't use it for an AOC declared wine. In terms of the domain, usually as long as they have a high proportion of old vines, that they actually believe that the young vines contribute something in terms of, how should I say, lightening, if you will, something that may be too concentrated and therefore inelegant without the addition of something that, because they have 70-year-old vines in a fair proportion of it, and therefore they think that in the case of Le Saint-Georges, they'd probably use it after the fourth or fifth year.
Especially in
Louis,
where it's very concentrated wines.
I think that's exactly right.
C'est la même chose pour les villages.
Oui, mais c'est vrai que le problème pourrait être très différent si on avait une seule parcelle, qu'on l'arrache totalement, et qu'on reparte avec du vin de jeune vigne à 100%. Donc là, c'est vrai qu'on peut se poser la question de savoir s'il ne faudrait pas attendre un petit peu plus longtemps pour avoir quelque chose un peu plus structuré, c'est sûr.
He also notes the point that if there is a case where they believe that it's best to rip up the whole parcel, he said, then you have a problem because you don't have the old vine offset. So he said, that's a head scratcher. They just have to decide whether they're getting enough quality to include it in some fashion or whether they'll sell it off in bulk or as some people do, some vintages that are naturally low yielding give you the concentration so you can make something interesting out of it. Other years, say 2004, which had a very, very high proportion of liquid to solid and therefore didn't give concentrated wines, perhaps you would declassify.
En termes de longévité,
one sec.
En termes de longévité,
Saint-Georges?
Oui.
Donc, longévité, il y a des bouteilles dans la cave qui sont très vieilles. Donc,
ouais.
Si c'est, on part sur une bonne année, je pense que par exemple 2005, c'est un vin à 40, 60 ans. Je pense que ça sera encore quelque chose. Hein.
Yeah, one sec, I'll take your question. I wanted Pierre to simply comment about the potential longevity of Le Saint-Georges, and he takes the 2005, for example. He's saying that 40 to 60 years is certainly within the realm of the possible. Pierre and I won't be here to enjoy that, but
you're not alone.
So he also notes that when properly stored, wines will last for much, much longer than people think. I'm actually working on a project of, I think I've mentioned this before, of a book on old Burgundy vintages, because that's kind of my passion within a career. And they've been kind enough to open some very, very difficult to find vintages, because somewhat ironically, it's not the great vintages that are difficult to find, because people keep them. It is the vintages that nobody wanted. They were basically the ugly ducklings. And so they've opened things like 1925, 1927, 1932, 1940, 1941 for me, none of which, you put all those together, you wouldn't have 2005. That's how difficult those vintages were. And yet the wines are still alive. No one would call them great, but the fact that they are still alive, have not been touched, says a lot for the longevity of the terroir of Nuits Saint-Georges. So the question? Yes, sir.
What would I pay for a bottle of this? The
You'd probably be at, off the top of my head, 100 and a quarter. Something like that, perhaps more for the 05. There may be somebody that's bought a bottle recently. The trouble with prices, of course, is they're all over the map. Especially from state to state, but even within California, you get some people that are pretty reasonable, and you have other people that... Okay. So. The keeper of the time.
She's just hungry.
Yes.
No, I can do this for hours.
Tells me that we have 20 minutes to go. So I signal that only so that we can get through the rest of the wines, and also let you know that to the extent that you have questions, 20 minutes, either that or you can try and catch either Pierre or I at that lunch. One interesting thing that we were talking about last night, I had the pleasure of sitting next to Pierre and Françoise. We talked about the funny character of 2004. And why was it that nobody saw that slight herbaceousness in the wines before or even just after they were bottled? Myself included, by the way. And lots of people have come up with ideas. Well, an idea that is circulating through Burgundy at the moment to try and explain some of this. By the way, that characteristic has largely, if not completely, disappeared. It was absolutely flagrant about 6 months after the Mies. And it was an herbaceousness, but it was an herbaceousness with sort of a tang to it that made it very, very pungent and not necessarily to everyone's taste. And my idea at the time was that it reminded me a bit of what happened in the 1986s, which had this character for a while, and after about 4 years, 1990 or so, it disappeared. But the theory, and this is an interesting one, is that there is a type of Asian ladybug called a coccinelle, and they were introduced as a way to be predators for little tiny insects in various gardens and so forth. Well, in 2004, there was an explosion of them, and they were everywhere. And even though people tried to eliminate them through triage, through shaking them, and so forth, there is at least some research now that is saying, geez, enough of these got into the cuvées, where was it enough to actually add a flavor or an aroma to the wines? And they give off a pheromone that tells predators, I'm not eatable. You don't want to eat me. And that pheromone, at least, is being considered, was it enough to alter the character of the wine? Now, I don't know the answer, and Pierre was also telling me last night that there was a Swiss researcher that took a 10 litres, tu as dit? 10 litres de vin?
pour son expérience?
Oui, des mini vinifications, yeah. Des petits récipients.
All right, so he took 10 liters of wine and then crushed one ladybug in one, took another 10 liters, crushed two, took another one, crushed three, and Pierre doesn't have the results of the experiment, but now I'm intrigued to try and go find out what happens.
Mais c'est une caractéristique qui fait partie du millésime, c'est la nature qu'on a décidé.
Yeah.
Peut-être c'est pas sûr.
So Pierre actually has a very Burgundian reaction to it, which is that it's actually part of the vintage. Nature obviously wanted it in there, so it's in there. 2001 was also one of the years that was very, very interesting. It was largely ripped by critics early on. I was one of the few champions for it, at least in the Côte de Nuit. It was difficult in the Côte d'Ivoire, particularly in Volnay, because Volnay was hit really, really hard by hail. But in the Côte de Nuit, the 2001s are lovely. And it is, again, one of those vintages where I try and encourage people to buy a bit of all the vintages. Americans in general tend to be very, very vintage-centric. If it's not 1999 or 2005, we don't want them. The only problem is that neither 1999 and certainly not 2005 is ready to drink. But if you had 2000, 2001, 2004, 1997 even, in your cellars, it gives you a chance to buy things that are not priced at the very, very highest level and that come around quicker. And it enables you to do two things. You can save some money. You don't have anguish when you go out on a Tuesday evening saying, well, I'd like something good to drink, but I'm not prepared to open a 2005 or a 1999, so you can choose a lesser vintage. And the third thing is that you can help yourself keep your hands off of the treasures while you give them a chance to mature to a state that they actually deserve to be. So, peut-être un peu de vos craintes?
Oui. Donc vos craintes, c'est un terroir qui est, comme on peut dire, sur l'étage en haut de Saint-Georges, c'est en haut des cailles, c'est en haut des... Donc sur des terres qui sont assez différentes, c'est des terres qui sont peu profondes, très argileuses, des argiles rouges très collantes, très dures, dures à travailler, et en fin de compte qui font des vins un petit peu dans le même style, quoi. Ou des vins qui sont un peu austères quelquefois, et qui demandent une garde peut-être un peu plus prolongée que les autres.
So, Vaucrin is much like the soil itself. It's sticky, there's a lot of clay, it is a very, very deep red, it's hard to work, there's not a lot of it, and it gives wine, as I mentioned earlier, is the linebacker. It is highly structured, tends to be dense, it tends to be austere in its youth, and it demands more time in bottle to come to a stage where it's civilized. But one of the things that's worth underscoring is that, to me, it's actually more of a classic Nuit than perhaps is Le Saint-Georges. Le Saint-Georges is an elegant, refined wine. There's muscle, but it's a gymnast. You know, it's cut. Whereas Vaucrin is this linebacker. But one of the things that I really like about it is that for those who like that characteristic that we would call sauvage, animal, very forest floor, kind of even a feral quality. And this really comes out with age. But it is almost that barnyardy character that doesn't come from Brett or from other smells that shouldn't be there. It is very much a sort of an animalistic wine because it develops those characteristics with time in bottle. And you can can pick it out. It's never ever refined. I don't think I've ever had a Vauquin that I would call refined, even in vintages like 1992, which were relatively light. And the one thing about collecting Vauquin, and there are a couple of very, very fine examples of it around, Gouges being among the very best, but be prepared to be patient. It is not a precocious wine, and it is a wine that in most vintages you need 10 or 12 years to actually have the tannins start to round out and become civilized. It is also a great wine to have with game, with beef. It's just that kind of wine. I'm no longer a linebacker, but in other days,
quelques mots sur 99?
Sur
99.
Sur le 99, le millésime.
Oui.
Donc 99, on a des gelées de printemps dans quelques endroits. C'est pas trop grave, mais il y a quelques pertes un peu. Donc ensuite, ça va plutôt bien, le temps est assez clément, mais on a un été chaud et humide qui va favoriser le mildiou. C'est une année à mildiou avec beaucoup de travail de ce côté-là. Manque d'ensoleillement l'été, mais heureusement, le temps sec s'installe à peu près à partir du 15 août et va complètement bloquer les maladies, enfin les champignons, parce qu'on commence à avoir des attaques de botrytis. Donc ils vont être bloqués par le temps chaud et sec, et puis on aura des vendanges le 22 septembre. Donc.
So I just asked Pierre to give us a couple of words on 1999, and essentially there was a difficult summer where mildew was a problem, and then botrytis developed. But beginning again in the middle of August and well into September was perfect weather. That became hot and dry, and so all the disease dried up, and it was one of the very, very few vintages in the 20th century where there was very high quality and very high quantity. I mean, you can basically count on one hand the number of vintages in Burgundy that will do that, and you essentially had 1919, 1934, 1959, 1990, and 1999. That's it. So you just don't get Pinot-based wines with high quality and high quantity.
On a 10 minutes, donc ça vaut la peine peut-être de présenter le Prulier et puis le Perrière.
D'accord. Donc Prulier, les parcelles se situent sur la même courbe de niveau que Poré. On est dans la bonne partie du coteau.
So that if you look at your map, Prulier is in the same band as Claude Poiret Saint-Georges, which again you find on the map under the name of Poiret.
Avec des terres qui sont un peu différentes, qui sont caillouteuses, mais qui seraient moins argileuses que Poiret, qui nous fait des vins, je veux pas dire plus tendres, mais c'est un peu comme dans cette idée-là quand même.
Okay. So there's more rock in the soil and less clay than in Claude Poiret Saint-Georges, and it tends to give a wine that is a bit lighter, a bit more elegant than its neighbor of Claude Poiret Saint-Georges.
Donc Prulier, sur le domaine gauche, c'est 2 hectares de vignes qui sont relativement âgées, à peu près entre 60 et 75 ans. Avec une partie qui a été replantée il y a maintenant 25 ans. Et là, on est sur des jeunes vignes qui sont en clone, donc avec un maximum de clones. On va avoir 6 ou 7 clones différents.
So they have 2 hectares, so fully 5 acres of it. And most of the vineyard is relatively aged, 70 years of age, but some of it was replanted to clones.
Et qu'est-ce que tu penses de la qualité des clones?
Ben, les clones, s'ils sont employés, pas unique numéro, je veux dire qu'il faut qu'il y ait un maximum de mélange, et qu'ils soient en plus assemblés avec des très vieilles vignes, ou des vieilles vignes, c'est-à-dire qu'il n'y a pas de problème. On va avoir du travail pour les maîtriser. On aura peut-être des vendanges vertes à faire, on aura à tailler peut-être plus court, à surtout pas mettre d'engrais, et ça se passe bien. Le matériel, à la fin, c'est des beaux raisins, c'est intéressant.
So I asked Pierre what his experience was with the clones, and he notes that they planted the maximum they could get. So there is no emphasis on one clone. And he's basically saying that you have to treat it differently. You have to prune differently. In certain years, you may have to do a green harvest, but that as long as you are rigorous, then there isn't a big difference between the quality of the raw materials coming from the clones than from the old vines.
Peut-être quelques mots sur le millésime, ton rôle à l'époque. Ouais.
Je vais juste rajouter une chose sur les clones, parce qu'on en parle beaucoup. Les clones, le problème avec les clones, c'est qu'il ne faut pas qu'ils remplacent la diversité des pinots noirs qui ont mis des siècles pour en arriver là où ils sont. Ce serait vraiment dommage de remplacer tout ça par des choses un peu plus techniques, quoi.
Pierre raises a very, very good point. For those of you that subscribe, you may have seen the editorial that I wrote about less diversity in Pinot Noir here, which I think contributes to some of the sameness that some wines have. And his goal in using the maximum number of clones possible was that he didn't want to arrive at a circumstance where the last 100 years of genetic diversity that has arisen in the vineyards of Burgundy, he all of a sudden didn't want to plant with a couple of clones that went in exactly the opposite direction than what the naturally selected vines had given him.
Les clones, je crois que c'est tout ce qu'on peut en dire. Okay. Enfin, on pourrait en parler longtemps.
Oui, c'est vrai. Mais peut-être le 70.
Alors le 70. Donc, on a voulu finir cette dégustation de rouge avec un vin un peu ancien. C'est une année assez moyenne, hein. C'est pas une très très grande année, mais c'était pour vous montrer un peu ce que le Pinot Noir peut faire dans certaines conditions, quelquefois extrêmes. La Bourgogne est quand même assez nord, elle est loin de la mer, elle est dans un climat continental. Le Pinot Noir a mis des siècles à s'installer et à s'adapter au sol et aux hommes et à toutes sortes de conditions. Et puis, même une année qui était un peu difficile, je pense qu'on a encore un peu de plaisir après 40 ans de bouteille.
Ouais. Pierre notes that he wanted to offer you the opportunity to taste something that was well-aged and comes from a year that no one would call as great. In fact, you could say that 1970 was, in fact, difficult. But that that's the genius of Burgundy, is that because of the huge benefit that the centuries have given, where the grape, the vine, could adapt to the soils of Burgundy, that even though the vintage was difficult, it still gives something that you can have a lot of pleasure with. So. Actually, I would like to join. I was going to save this till the end, but since we're here, I think it's extremely generous of the Domaine to have offered something, like I said, is knocking on the door of 40 years of age, so that we can all enjoy it. And even more so is that they presented a vintage that you wouldn't call great. And that takes nerve in and of itself, because a lot of Domaines don't want to present vintages that are difficult. They prefer to present those that are understood to be great, and you had the benefit of Mother Nature. Here you tend to see what the terroir had to offer. And we have just time enough to present the very, very last wine. So it is the white that was poured a moment ago, and it's a 2003 Perrière, which is also a Nuit Saint-Georges Premier Cru.
Donc Perrière,
si on veut parler de la parcelle, c'est un ancien nom qui voulait désigner la carrière, l'endroit où on extrayait de la pierre. Donc c'est une zone qui est très pauvre, qui est très caillouteuse, avec des sols qui ne sont pas très profonds. Et donc Henri Gouge a jugé bon de mettre cette parcelle en pinot blanc. Il pensait que c'était plus adapté à un blanc que les terres un peu plus riches du bas. Donc pour l'histoire de ce pinot blanc, bon, c'est peut-être un peu long, mais on va essayer de faire court.
Ok. Very quickly.
In reading the material, comment on the grapes.
But it's Pinot Blanc.
It's Pinot Blanc.
Yeah. Pinot Blanc.
But very quickly, Perrière comes from to designate a place where there was an old quarry, because it was very, very rocky, and much of the building material in France, not just in Burgundy, because much of when you walk around the hillsides, you'll see quarries everywhere, and this is an old quarry site. And Henri Gouge looked at the site and said that I think this would be interesting to put Pinot Blanc here as opposed to Pinot Noir.
Donc ce Pinot Blanc, il est arrivé un peu par hasard parce que c'était pas du tout dans la tradition. En 1936, pendant les vendanges, il a observé un cep sur lequel il y avait deux raisins blancs, alors que les autres étaient encore noirs. Donc ça les a suffisamment intrigués pour qu'ils le marquent. Et l'année suivante, le cep était entièrement raisin blanc.
So, this is everybody, well, perhaps not everyone has heard, but some of you may have heard that this is what came from the basically Henri Gouge developed this particular strain of white wine and or grape. And what happened was is that in 1936 he noticed that one of the vines had red bunches but two white bunches, and so he was sufficiently intrigued by this that he marked the vine. And in 1937, when he came back, it was all the bunches were white. So they have called this Pinot Gouge.
Donc c'est vrai que c'est une chose qui s'est pas trop expliquée à l'époque, mais ça les a intéressés. Ils ont multiplié donc des greffons jusqu'à faire 300 ou 400 pieds qu'ils ont plantés dans la même zone, dans le Clos des Porrets, pour voir si c'était intéressant, si ça faisait intéressant ou pas, et puis surtout si c'était stable, si ça n'allait pas revenir en arrière.
Right. He said that what they decided to do was to propagate this. And so they created 300 or 400 of these vines, and they planted them. And what he was really curious to see is to make sure that they weren't cross-dressers, so that they didn't switch back to Pinot Noir.
Et donc c'est seulement après la guerre, en 47, que la parcelle des Perrières a été plantée. Donc sur un terrain qui n'avait jamais eu de vigne, ils ont rangé, nettoyé, ils ont planté cette vigne, et c'est toujours la même qui produit aujourd'hui.
So, this vineyard was planted with the strain of Pinot Gouge in 1947, and it hasn't been replanted, so that's what is in your glass, is basically a genetic mutation of Pinot Noir, known as Pinot Gouge.
Donc, à l'époque, il y a des spécialistes de la viticulture qui sont venus voir ce plan, mais avec les moyens de l'époque, ils ont trouvé que c'était un Pinot, mais voilà. Et puis, il y a 3 ou 4 ans, j'ai rencontré un scientifique qui fait de la recherche sur les ADN des cépages. Et je lui ai parlé de ce plan, je lui ai donné des morceaux de bourgeons, des morceaux de feuilles pour qu'ils sortent la séquence ADN. Mm-hmm. Et j'ai eu la réponse quelques mois après. Il m'a dit, c'est réellement un pinot et la seule chose qui a changé, c'est la couleur de la peau. Pour le reste, c'est un pinot noir.
So basically, this is really white pinot noir because at the time, they didn't have the means to really look at what it was. But 4 years ago, Pierre met a scientist that specializes in ampelography, so he gave him a leaf and one of the buds, And he had the answer that it really was Pinot Noir, except for the color of the skin. So it is white Pinot. White according Pinot. To the scientist, at least.
Albinos, was their name.
Yeah, problem. So it's, you know, whether it's albino Pinot or. So we're going to take two questions, and then that's all the time we have. Yes, sir.
Do you feel that all the honey is typical for the vineyard and the grapes, or is that more 2003?
That's 2000. It's 2003. The question was, is all the honey in the wine basically the vintage, or is that the wine? And at least with my experience with the wine, it's very much the vintage. 2003 was the earliest and hottest year since 1893. So when you say it's the hottest vintage in 110 years, smoking. It's atypical, and that contributes, because it actually can drink like a red, which is not surprising given its origins, but it's normally more elegant than the vintage allows it to be. But then again, there's virtually nothing in Burgundy in 2003 that you'd call elegant, red or white. They're interesting, and they can be delicious, but elegant is probably not a word that you'd use very often.
If I reserved it blind, I'd probably guess it was Moussard.
Yeah, well, that exotic quality is something that 2003 gave. And we had one last question. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so this was a natural clonal migration to this white wine, but is this, in fact, the same thing as Pinot Blanc, for instance, grown in Alsace? Is it the same? This occurred naturally, evolved in this vineyard this way, but is it the same as Pinot Blanc grown elsewhere?
Tu as compris?
Pas toujours.
OK. Il demande si c'est la même chose que Pinot Blanc. Par exemple, le Pinot Blanc en Alsace.
Non. C'est réellement un Pinot Noir qui... Alors après, on l'appelle comme on veut, mais la grappe est exactement la petite grappe du Pinot Noir. Les feuilles, jusqu'à la véraison, il n'y a pas de différence avec les voisins. Non, je ne pense pas qu'on puisse s'apparenter.
We ran into a bit of... translation difficulty in that when Pierre said Pinot Blanc, he meant white Pinot, as opposed to Pinot Blanc, the grape variety that you would find, as you say, in Alsace or elsewhere. This is perhaps otherwise said, this is white Pinot Noir.
But is white Pinot Noir Pinot Blanc? No.
At least not to my understanding. I'm sorry, in order to accommodate everyone at lunch, I have to cut off, but if you want to come up. You can ask the question at the restaurant, or you can come up now. But I hope that you had a good time. Hope that you might have... I appreciate all your loyalty and coming, and loyalty to the world of Pinot Noir. And also, I didn't have a chance earlier to introduce Françoise Gouge, but you should stand up, and another member of the family. And I would just add one final word, that it was a real pleasure to participate with Pierre. And like I said, I hope you all had fun. So, okay. And Pierre would like to add, for all the sommeliers, that he very much appreciates the professionalism, because they were served exactly as they should be, at the right temperature, and the wine showed as he would wanted them to have shown. So.